Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Tube podcast. We're going to be talking about some jazz history, but a part of the history that rarely gets attention by fans, but really should. Jazz, you know, being a jazz musician is a profession. It is a livelihood. And, you know, as fans, we see the artists on the stage, or we hear them on record or on streaming now, and we're sort of dealing with them on a purely artistic level. But, you know, when the show's over, and in between shows, they have to deal with a lot of business issues. It's a tough business. It's physically hard. It's commercially hard. Even in the best of times, and like all workers, they need protection. And one of the forms of protection for workers is unionization. And musicians have unions. And we're going to talk about one of the big union, Local 802 in New York, its history, and all the twists and turns it went through, and all the heroic figures that, you know, were involved in helping reform the situation, working conditions for musicians, and some of the clubs that got spun off by these labor activists too. So it's a very interesting story, and it was written by a guy who wrote it originally for his college thesis, and his name is Jacob Goldberg, and he's joining us from the great state of Oregon, in Portland in specific. Welcome, Jacob.
Hi, Ken. Thanks.
Yeah, Jacob, I stumbled on your article in the February issue of Allegro, which is the is Local 802's monthly magazine for its members, the Associated Musicians of Greater New York.
Right.
So, you know, these issues are super important to musicians, and they do have an impact on the history of the music and the music we actually ultimately get to hear. So, before we started recording, you were telling me about the unusual character of this union, that it was one of the first unions, not only first music unions, but first unions of any kind in the United States to be integrated. Could you talk a little bit about that history?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, so the reason Local 802 publishes, you know, parts of this history work I'd done, you know, a couple years ago, is that it was really a history about a civil rights history about integration within, you know, the Musicians Union in New York City. And it was, I think, like, you know, a little bit unique and commendable because prior to the 1930s, a lot of the labor movement in the United States, and especially even in among Musicians Union, you know, we don't just have a Musicians Union in New York City. There's still musicians unions all over the country in different locals, and then they're part of the larger federation. But many of the different local unions either didn't accept African-American musicians or had segregated locals. So, for instance, in Chicago, for many years, they had a Black Musicians Union and a White Musicians Union. But New York City had never had that history. Dating back to the 1880s, actually, they had always accepted African-American musicians into their local. And so it's, I think, you know, a kind of positive story in labor history and civil rights history and American history that I think you're right, probably hasn't gotten the attention that it could have gotten. And so, you know, when I was an undergraduate, I went back and I looked at a lot of the, you know, sources and, you know, the minutes of the board meetings and the newsletter, which was called various different things, and sort of tried to trace the history of how African American musicians integrated this New York City musicians union. And then not just that, but then they also became active participants in the union and encouraged it to become involved in the civil rights movement, you know, prior to, you know, a lot of other portions of the labor movement doing so.
Well, you mentioned that there was in 1928, in January in particular, a group of black union members sent a petition with their grievances to the union about certain issues, and of course, you know, musicians like all workers have a lot of issues, you know, working conditions, pay, length of hours, how they're treated in general. But for African American musicians, there was also the issue of even though the union was integrated, the workplaces were often not.
Right.
And you surmised that they wanted the union to address that way back in 1928.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, one of the interesting aspects I think about how African American, one of the things that changed in the 20s was, so when the first musicians joined Local 802 in the 1880s, they were classical musicians. And so African-American musicians, like the first musician who joined the Local was a violinist. And that was because the union didn't really recognize like popular or vernacular music, you know, prior to the 1920s. It was really like a professional organization of people who they considered professionals, which were classically trained musicians. And those included, you know, at that time, African-American musicians in New York specifically who were accomplished professional classical musicians. But a major change in music and the music industry in the 1920s is that African-American music became a commercially successful, you know, type of music. And because of that, it became a professional field in the same way that classical music had been prior to that. And there's, you know, this is not like a unique or unknown story. Everyone knows that jazz emerged. Although the first popular jazz band, I think, was also a white, in terms of the music business side of it, was like a white band. And then, you know, people recognized that a lot of African-American musicians, you know, were accomplished in that field. And then they started to get that kind of work. And so there was this kind of shift among the types of African-American musicians in the 20s who were parts of the union. At first, they had been these classical musicians. And then in the 20s, it was a lot of sort of jazz musicians and blues musicians and, you know, sort of what we would consider kind of popular musicians who were union members. And that gave them a lot more power, I think, because they were able to corner parts of the market. And so they were able to push this labor union to take their concerns a lot more seriously than it had when it was principally a union that represented classical musicians.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And I imagine too, by 28, radio was starting to, you know, the power of radio was beginning to be felt. Phonograph records were probably a lot more prevalent. It was probably a boom era.
One of the things about phonographs as a tool for integration is you can't see the color of the person who's playing on a recording. And so I think the recording industry has this, you know, capability to make fields integrated in ways that, you know, just, you know, performances didn't. Another thing that changed in the 20s, like I was sort of describing how popular African American musicians became popular, but initially a lot of the music they played was in sort of degrading, like in minstrel shows. And then as jazz and blues became more popular, it became music that really respected and gave voice to people, you know, as a result of their background and their race, and wasn't just the kind of performance that degraded them. And I think you're right that radio and phonographs are part of that, because people would listen to it and enjoy the music, and they didn't sort of just view people through their, I think at that time, biased lenses. They were able to sort of recognize people's accomplishments and geniuses just through the art they created.
Yeah, and possibly instead of being treated as characters, they were now individuals. You know, taking, for example, Louis Armstrong. He wasn't a character. He was Louis Armstrong, the man.
So,
go ahead.
I think, so in certain ways, you know, we started this with saying, you know, the musicians union, and this is a well-known story, that music has always provided this capacity for people to have expression and political voice, you know, in ways that aren't available necessarily, you know, in the rest of our culture and our economy. And I think the union was an example about how people who were able to use their art to create this kind of expression and voice, and also a way for them to earn a living. I remember reading through these old, you know, African-American periodicals, and there would be, like, newspaper articles that would say, like, we're in jazz, make a lot of money, that, like, through playing music, it was also a way to establish, like, a middle-class familiar style and, you know, have sort of a dignity that wasn't available in a lot of other parts of culture. And, you know, the union then became a little bit responsive to that as people, you know, sort of became more active and organized on their own.
Yeah, if you think about it, in the 20s, professions like medicine, law, engineering, college professorships, those would have been largely denied African Americans. So if somebody wanted a profession with some, you know, some dignity and the chance to travel, the chance to make money, music would have been a great pathway. And so those it's interesting that you saw those ads in the various African American journals pointing that at jazz as a career opportunity. So now,
and I think the union itself established people. We're kind of like, you know, I think in a certain period of its history, it's still all to this day, I think the union, getting a union card and being a member of the musicians union is like a part of your kind of recognition and establishment of yourself as a professional musician. I don't know if I remember reading that in earlier periods of union history, you had to like sort of take a music proficiency exam in order to become a union member. And, you know, certainly by paying dues, you had to illustrate that you were earning a certain amount of money. And so I think the union was part of what you're talking about, that if you could join the union, you know, make money as a musician, you could be a professional in the same way that you could be like a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. And the fact that they, you know, the union, at least in New York, was open to people across the color line, I think, you know, it was an avenue for people to, you know, establish that kind of professionalism that may have been denied to them in other areas.
So speaking of, we're talking about how radio and phonograph records and the commercialization of you know, African-American music forms, them becoming popular, them becoming, good money makers. That was an artifact of the 1920s. But then in the 1930s, it kind of whipsawed. You had the Depression, which I don't know if people are aware what a devastating effect that had on the music industry. I know, for instance, I wish I had the numbers handy. I don't. But record sales, cratered, didn't go down 10, 20%. People just didn't have the money to buy records. They didn't have as much money to go out. So you had hard times for working musicians.
Yeah, I mean, for everyone. It's interesting, the Depression. So in the 20s, just generally, I think in American labor history, it was not a progressive period, you know, in terms of the union movement. And then the 1930s, you know, from my reading of American labor history, there was a kind of rethinking of capitalism, and, you know, it was this crisis that kind of emerged, and a lot of the systems that people had built up to support themselves didn't exist anymore, and there was a lot of pressures in all kinds of areas. And so the New York Musicians Union, what I understand happened was they were kind of rocked. There was this, you know, a lot of job loss, dissension. The union was, people were very dissatisfied with the union's capacity to create and support people's jobs. And then there was a reformist movement within the union, you know, which I think paralleled what happened in the labor movement writ large, where sort of more progressive individuals, including certain individuals with ties to leftist organizations and some African Americans, were able to take control of their union. And, you know, at that period, there had been this issue that the New York Union had been controlled for various bureaucratic reasons by the National Federation. But in the 30s, the local musicians retook their labor movement and established local autonomy. And then there was this kind of renaissance that happened for a variety of reasons. Then the union really expanded after that period. So there was this kind of depression that happened, but then a progressive kind of response ultimately to it that made the union more democratic and then grew it. And then I think there were also certain aspects of the 1930s and the New Deal that made unionization in the arts and music more possible. So for instance, the WPA, which was, you know, an aspect of the New Deal, employed many musicians, and they were almost always union jobs. And Local 802 made an effort to organize the jobs, also make sure that they were integrated. And so the Depression, and then the other thing that happened is, I think earlier, this transformation of how black music became really popular in the 1920s, but in the 30s, with the swing era, it exploded. And, you know, swing music, you know, through the 30s and the 40s was American popular music and commercially successful on a scale that, you know, previous kinds of popular African-American music hadn't been. And also, it was an incredible employer of musicians in ways that previous types of music hadn't, and an employer of African-American musicians. And so the 1930s ended up being sort of the heyday of, you know, African-American musicians' participation in Local 802, and also I think Local 802's importance and, you know, its sort of power within music industry in New York and you know its influence, you know, generally in New York politics.
Gotcha. Hey, let's talk about there were, in addition to the strict, you know, the labor action that took place, there was also some creative stuff going on too. That mixed with, for lack of a better word, labor consciousness. You mentioned that there's a guy named Bert Hall who, in 1930, created something called the Rhythm Club. What was the function of the Rhythm Club? Where was it? And actually, I have the address here. It was at 168 West 132nd Street. And it was Hall who picked that up. Tell us a little bit about Bert Hall.
Well, I don't know his entire history, but I remember he came to New York. I think he was from Chicago and he'd been a guitar player. You may know it better than me, but he was one of the series. So one of the things that happened was, it wasn't just that the unions organized, musicians organized through the union. There were also a lot of what I would call mutual support organizations among African American musicians. So there would be like these clubs where, you know, musicians would gather. I think they would kind of hang out. They would probably practice. They would probably network and do business. And, The Rhythm Club, which Bert Hull, I think, was kind of the principal of, was one of those organizations. And it was one of those organizations in the 30s, and I think it became kind of this focal point for musicians and support organization that musicians could go to. But, you know, and Bert Hall, I think, was a little bit unique, at least in terms of the labor history aspect, that he, I think, was one of the first people to really become very seriously involved in Local 802 because he was part of what I described earlier as this reformist movement to take back the autonomy, you know, of Local 802. And so he became one of the people who sort of took back the union and represented African musicians on its board. He was the first executive board member who was an African-American musician. But I think the important part about the Rhythm Club and that kind of history is it wasn't like this just sort of happened, you know, all of a sudden. There were always these organizations. There was the Clef Club, which James Reese Europe had started, and then there was the New Amsterdam Musical Association, and then, you know, there were various other particularly African-American organizations that were kind of mutual protective organizations but didn't totally function like a labor union, but they, like, sort of supported African-American musicians and, you know, allowed them to have their own kind of organization, and then they were able to represent themselves in, you know, the general union. I guess in other cities, the way it must have worked is that the segregated local must have taken on the function that, say, the Rhythm Club did. But in New York, there was sort of a more developed sort of organizational system where people had these protective what I call protective organizations, and then they were also able to go to their sort of larger union and have, you know, a whole voice within the general kind of labor movement, not just, you know, for themselves.
Gotcha. I know, just as a sidebar, New Orleans, like every city in America, I think the only other city that had an integrated musicians union, interestingly enough, was Detroit and their local five. But every other place was segregated. And I guess just a funny story. The union finally became integrated, I think, in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah.
And the Black Musicians Union building was sold, and a guy who's become a friend of mine bought it. And one
of
the things
in Detroit, it was sold.
No, I'm sorry. This was New Orleans. I'm sorry. So I think Detroit might have always been integrated as well. I'll have to look that up. But New Orleans definitely was not. And what was interesting is he found some of the union records. And, of course, they keep track of the gigs and, you know, who performed where, when, and so on. And I think even the amounts of money involved. And there's this mythology that Louis Armstrong left New Orleans in the 20s and only came back decades later to participate in one of the Mardi Gras parades. And that turns out to be not true at all. The I think they call it the Negro Musicians Union at that time. But that union showed very clearly that Louis Armstrong came back to New Orleans dozens of times and performed. Now, he might have just been performing for African-American audiences, but he came back a lot. So there's a case where this segregated union system, it was almost two different worlds. In other words, the official history, if you read the official history, the so-called official history of Louis Armstrong, he never went back to New Orleans after he left. And the real history is he did all the time, and it's documented by the African-American organization representing the musicians. So there was a huge problem with African-American musicians getting employed and then getting the union to take the discrimination against them seriously. And so that's one of the things that the African-American
I think in the music industry, it's always a challenge of getting employed. You know, I think it's always been a challenge for people to make a living doing music. And I think, you know, like we were talking about, that the unique American, like African-American music, New York City, elsewhere, it's this kind of unique, amazing story that people were able to kind of take this art, make it popular, make, create bridges to the larger community that, didn't exist. I think in New York it also became this kind of example when they integrated the rest of the AFM in the 1960s, like you were talking about. You know, there was a lot of concern about whether it could happen, and maybe it's still happening for us now. People were worried that they couldn't do it. And, you know, there was universal kind of, everyone looked to New York and said, look, New York City was never segregated, and it worked well there. You know, unionism in New York worked pretty well for people. And so I think, like, the whole story about how this was an integrated local in New York City and how African-American musicians were able to sort of to have a voice within their labor movement in New York City, I think that's important. You know, it's like a full story, but it's partially how we got the civil rights movement, is people could see these examples of integration. And that was, you know, then the rest of the places that weren't integrated could say, look, it is possible. You know, what happened in New York was possible in Chicago or New Orleans or other places. And, you know, I think that's ultimately the sort of inspiring part of the story, is that it started with people who were professional classical musicians. Then they, you know, made great art through jazz and blues and commercially successful art through swing. They also organized their own support organizations like the Rhythm Club and places like that. And then they were able to sort of create a functional, responsive union movement that organized across the color line. And then other people saw that and were able to say, look, integration, the civil rights movement, it works, it's possible. And then, you know, we make some strides forward.
Gotcha.
But, yeah. I mean, I think I remember talking with the woman who's now deceased, and she's been active and located too. And, you know, she still complains that Broadway is not as integrated as it could be, or, you know, orchestra, the classical field isn't as integrated as it could be. And so I don't think that, you know, I think this is a very positive, like one of these positive stories in American history, but then it's also obviously a work in progress in Locoito too. And obviously the rest of the country. But I think the story of how, you know, jazz and blues and people becoming accomplished musicians allowed them to have political voices and economic participation, that should be a positive thing that we recognize in America and, you know, take some inspirations with. So
sure. And
I
also
think that's why the local keeps, you know, putting it, you know, publishing parts of this story every February, because I think it's something they should be really proud of, that this was something that was a little bit unique in American history, you know.
Well, and also that African-American union members took a leadership role.
Yes, absolutely.
In reforming the union, in getting Local 802 independent of the national union.
Right.
Hey, let's talk about one of the other players, a guy named Joe Jordan, who was a ragtime composer.
Right.
And he was, you say that he was the first black member ever elected to a union leadership position.
Yeah. I think he was another one of these, you know, people in the 30s, if I remember correctly, he was kind of a Scott Joplin kind of disciple. And I think he was sort of a ragtime musician. And then I think he, you know, in the 30s, you know, became part of one of these tickets, you know, to be on the board of the union. And then also, you know, once he became, I think he became elected in a position in the union. And then I think he was one of the people who, you know, sort of tried to get the union to be more involved in Harlem and, you know, push the union to sort of pay attention to what was going on in Harlem. So they didn't have, you know, what you were describing in New Orleans, where, you know, there was kind of stuff happening and, you know, the African-American kind of market, but then, you know, the union didn't pay attention. And then also, I think, you know, several other people, he was someone who helped the union become involved in political actions. And then I guess another thing I think I understand about him is he had contacts, you know, in other cities, and, you know, I think maybe help people get work or, you know, was involved in, you know, having the union be involved in other cities with African-American musicians and recruiting them to New York City.
Gotcha. And of course, the, you know, New York was segregated in those days, you know, in a de facto way.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the entertainment venues, so there was almost like a different industry running in Harlem versus what was running downtown.
I remember there were, you know, another thing that the union, I remember, for instance, there was a drive to integrate motion picture operate, like not get people African-Americans jobs and then allow them to join the union. There was like a union, there used to be all these unions, there may still be, I don't know, there were all these unions in the entertainment field, and there was one for motion picture operators. And so it was like, I guess like the technicians who would like run the films. And like there was this drive, I can't remember what it's called now, but there was like an organization that was kind of an umbrella organization of African-American labor union activists. And they were trying to organize motion picture operators. And they went to Local 802, and Local 802 actively supported that kind of drive in the 30s. And so they were also part of sort of trying to integrate other, like what you were describing, trying to combat segregation and kind of these adjacent fields. That it wasn't just siloed into the, you know, in music. They were also trying to spill over and try and help, you know, people who worked in other parts of, you know, the entertainment industry also, you know, have a voice and become integrated.
Gotcha. And one of the problems that the union was facing was what you call kickbacks and something called chiseling. Can you talk a little bit about that? How, why that was a problem for working musicians and how the union handled it initially, and then how the, you know, thanks to the agitation of certain members, it got handled in a better way.
I mean, I think I recall there were always, so chiseling, I think kickbacks were a rise, basically. And I think there were always, and, you know, people you would talk to in the union would say this, but I think it was always hard to enforce the collective bargaining agreement and that. And there were always people cheating that system. And then I think a lot of times African-American musicians became the victims of cheating, you know, for whatever reason, you know, well, probably the reason was racism, but, you know, were often victims of these, you know, kind of practices that undermine labor standards. And then the always kind of tested, they would have these, through all these, maybe it's like trial board hearings, or they would issue fines and citations, and they undermine, and then they would put people on the unfair list or tell people not. So there was like sort of official channels and a kind of self-enforced regulatory system they had to, you know, kind of enforce their own rules, you know, or not their own rules, rules that they created in partnership with the industry. And then also there was a kind of sort of attempt at sort of peer pressure or, you know, sort of exposure of people who cheated. And I think this, you know, when the union had more power, like in the late 30s and 40s, you know, their ability to combat those, you know, the undermining of the labor standards worked better. And then when in later periods of the musicians' union history, as with, you know, a lot of labor history, it became more difficult, you know, after that period.
Gotcha. And one of the themes of this of the article that appears in Allegro is that African American musicians in the union just played an essential role in reforming the union and helping it strengthen itself on behalf of its members.
Right. Yeah, that was my whole, thesis that I was describing to you, was that, it wasn't an example of integration, but it wasn't this, benevolent, kind of activity by even the well-meaning white labor leaders. That was a result of many years of African-American musicians sort of perfecting their art and establishing commercial responsibility, and then organizing among themselves and petitioning, like we talked about earlier, the Bird Hall petitioning the board to do certain things or becoming part of the board and having the political power because they had their own organizations and commercial success and, had, a certain number of people employed in the field that allowed them to gain representation on the board. And so through their own efforts, they were able to establish integration, a civil rights movement that sort of made anti-racism one of its chief concerns, in a period when that wasn't the case in, for instance, the mine workers union or, in generally in New York City or certainly in other parts of the country. And so, what I described earlier was, that music has this capacity to allow people to establish, or allow certain people to establish economic stability and also take political action because they were so successful through their art. And, in a certain way, this was always kind of the Harlem Renaissance. I think from what I have read about it, that was always sort of the official idea, is that you would take art and make it into this sort of political civil rights platform. There was a historian, David Loving Lewis, who said the Harlem Renaissance was civil rights by copyright. And I think the musicians, obviously, they were part of the civil rights movement, but their efforts extended previous to that and extended after it. And they were probably the most successful example of how successful art and commercially successful music allowed you to take or push for political action through the labor movement.
Gotcha. And this would have set an example for other not only other musicians but other, and not only other labor organizations but even to society as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people have written histories of the civil rights movement, they don't say that the 1960s just sprung up out of the middle of nowhere. But there was always kind of an undercurrent of both cooperation and integration, and then also of resistance and efforts, this sort of have what they call the Black Freedom Struggle, has gone on, since the beginning of American history. And then there are these moments when it really sort of comes and works, and Local 802 for a long period of history was one of those where it was really working. And, I think it's so obvious that everyone talks Louis Armstrong, I think, and Duke Ellington, those people were such important figures in American history and American culture. And it's so obvious that they made an impact and it, made the civil rights movement possible. But it's not as obvious that there were people like you mentioned, like Bert Hall and Joe Jordan and all the other musicians who were, equally part of this kind of long transition in American history. And, the union movement was kind of part of how they did that. So I think that's kind of the general theme and, inspiration I took out of Local 802's history.
Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington are kind of like generals in a sense, in that everybody knows
exactly.
Their name. They're high profile, but nobody knows the names of the foot soldiers who were in the trenches, who were doing some of the very important day-to-day work. So I think that's what really inspired me when I read your article, to know that there was this activity going on, and what an important role musicians played in making society better above and beyond their creative contributions. They also have made many, many, many social contributions. And in your article, or in your thesis, you get into that in great detail. For people that want to get further into this, Jacob's thesis is called Swingin' the Color Line, African-American Musicians and the Formation of Local 802. And it sounds like you can go to lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com, and you can get the whole thing. Also, if you are a member of the Local 802, there was an excerpt of Jacob's article in the February 2020 issue, and that try to get your hands on that. It's really good. But
yeah, they'll publish. So the union and Allegro, I think it's been like the last 10 years, they published it in serial form, kind of different sections of the larger work. And I think what we sort of view it as is like it's part of, you know, Black History. It's always February Black History Month. And so this is, you know, kind of the story of the union as being part of that Black history. So
gotcha.
That's why it comes out in the logo.
Gotcha. By the way, this is a fantastic publication. The 802 really does a great job on this. And apparently the expansion of Allegro into a serious publication started with the reform movement in the 1930s. So
Yeah.
Well, Jacob, thank you so much for taking the time to share some of the details of this and also to do the original scholarship and put it in black and white so there's a record of it so people can know about these great people and what they did and the impact they had, not only for musicians in New York, but musicians around the U.S. and then even in the labor movement in general.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so happy people read this. I mean, I think it's kind of fun to go back and learn about, you know, I remember like reading through the archives and then getting to talk to, you know, older musicians and, you know, learn about their history. And I think people are, you know, it's very remarkable, you know, what people have done in the past and, you know, that the labor movement still exists, that this still, you know, that Allegro is still a great publication. And, you know, I'm so happy that, you know, some people will, you know, pay attention to what I've written and then maybe, you know, look for more. And so thank you for, you know, allowing me to talk about it because I found it very interesting as well.
Well, it's also an inspiration for current struggles, you know, to be aware of the great people in the past and what they did. Well, great. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Jacob Goldberg, author of Swingin' the Color Line, African-American Musicians and the Formation of Local 802, and fascinating study, and I'm really glad that he documented it for us. So, Jacob, thanks a lot, and we'll see you around the Internet.
Okay. Thank you, Ken.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the Internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.